Moralia, quamodo adulator ob amico internoscitur. To the man who declares himself intensely fond of himself, Antiochus Philopappus, Plato says that all people grant pardon, though the very greatest of vices grows up along with many others because of it, a vice on account of which one cannot be a just and unbiased judge of oneself. For the one who loves is blinded regarding the beloved. Unless someone has learned and been trained to honor and pursue what is noble more than what is merely one's own and akin to oneself. This gives the flatterer a wide field to operate in, between friendship and himself, since he has in our self-love a natural base of operations against us. For each of us, being first and foremost a flatterer of himself, readily admits the outside flatterer as a witness and confirmer of the very opinions he already holds and wishes to be true about himself. The man commonly reviled as fond of flatterers is in fact intensely fond of himself. Out of goodwill toward himself, he wants everything good to belong to him, and believes that it does, a wish that is not absurd in itself, but a belief that is precarious and requires great caution. Now, if truth is indeed something divine, and is, according to Plato, the source of all good things for the gods and of all good things for men, then it is likely that the flatterer is an enemy of the gods, and especially of Pythian Apollo. For he is forever arrayed against the precept, "Know thyself," implanting in each person a delusion about himself, an ignorance of himself, and of the good and bad things that pertain to him, making some of these defective and incomplete, others wholly incapable of correction. Now if, like most of the other vices, flattery attacked only or mainly the base and worthless, it would not be so terrible or so hard to guard against. But since, just as woodworms burrow especially into the soft and sweet-tasting timbers, so too the ambitious, decent, and reasonable characters are the ones that receive the flatterer and nourish him as he attaches himself to them. And further, just as Simonides says that horse breeding does not accompany Zacynthus, but the wheat-bearing plains, so we observe that flattery does not follow the poor, the obscure, or the powerless, but becomes a besetting slip and disease of great households and great affairs, and often overturns kingdoms and dominions. The examination of flattery is thus no small task, nor one that calls for slight forethought, if it is, being so exceedingly hard to detect, not to harm or slander friendship. For lice leave the dying and abandon their bodies once the blood on which they feed grows cold, but flatterers are never at all to be seen approaching affairs that are dry and chilled. Rather, they fasten themselves upon reputations and positions of power and grow there, but quickly slip away in times of change. Yet one ought not to wait for that late experience, which is unprofitable, or rather harmful, and not without danger. For in a time of need for friends, the perception that one's supposed friends are not friends at all is a grievous thing, offering no exchange of something sound and secure for something unsound and counterfeit. Rather, just as one must have a coin tested and approved before the moment of need, not put to the proof by the need itself, so too with a friend. We ought not to become aware of the harm only after being harmed, but should gain experience and understanding of the flatterer precisely in order not to be harmed. Otherwise, we shall suffer the same fate as those who realize, from having already tasted them, that certain drugs are deadly only once the poison is working to destroy and corrupt them. For we praise neither these people nor those who, setting down as the mark of a friend what is noble and beneficial, suppose that they can immediately catch in the very act, as flatterers, those who converse pleasantly. For a friend is not unpleasant or unmixed with charm, nor is friendship a solemn thing that is bitter and harsh. Rather, this very nobility and solemnity of friendship is itself sweet and something to be longed for, and the graces and desire have made their home beside it. And it is not only to a man in misfortune that it is sweet, as Euripides says, to look into the eyes of a well-disposed man. Friendship brings pleasure and grace to the good no less than it removes pains and perplexities from the unfortunate and attends them. And just as Evenus said that fire is the best of seasonings, so the god, by mixing friendship into life, has made all things bright and sweet and dear to us when friendship is present and sharing in the enjoyment. Indeed, how could the flatterer slip in among our pleasures if he saw that friendship nowhere admitted what is pleasant? It cannot be said. But just as false gold and counterfeit coin imitate only the brightness and gleam of real gold. So too the flatterer, imitating the pleasant and gratifying quality of the friend, always tries to present himself as cheerful and blooming, and never opposing or standing against anyone. Hence we ought not straightway to suspect, simply as flatterers, those who praise us. For praise belongs to friendship no less than blame does, when the occasion calls for it. Or rather, a wholly difficult and fault-finding temper is unfriendly and unsociable. Whereas we readily and without pain endure the admonition and outspokenness, in turn, of the goodwill that generously and eagerly bestows praise on what is noble, trusting, and loving such a person as one who blames only out of necessity, since he praises gladly. One might therefore say it is a hard thing to distinguish the flatterer from the friend, if they do not differ either in giving pleasure or in giving praise. For indeed in services and attentions, too one can often see friendship being overtaken and outrun by flattery. Why should it not be so, we shall reply, if we are pursuing the true flatterer, one who handles the matter with cleverness and art, rather than, as most people do, reckoning as flatterers those so-called self-invited guests and table companions, spoken of as being heard from only after the water for washing hands has been passed round, men whose lack of freedom becomes obvious to all over a single dish and cup amid buffoonery and coarseness. Surely there was no need to expose Melanthius, the parasite of Alexander of Pherae, who, to those who asked how Alexander had been stabbed, would say, "Through the ribs into my own belly." Nor those who circle around a rich table, whom neither fire nor iron nor bronze keeps from frequenting a dinner. Nor the flattering women of Cyprus who, once they crossed over into Syria, were called ladder women, because they would bend down and offer themselves as steps for the wives of kings to climb up onto their carriages. Whom, then, must we guard against? The one who does not seem and does not admit to be flattering, who cannot be caught hanging about the kitchen, nor detected measuring out shadows for a dinner invitation, nor found sprawled out drunk however it happens to fall out, but is for the most part sober and meddlesome, and thinks he ought to have a share in one's affairs, and wants to be a partner in one's secret words, and is altogether a tragic, not a satiric or comic, actor of friendship. For just as Plato says it is the extreme of injustice to seem just without being so, so too we must regard as dangerous the flattery that goes undetected, not the kind that admits itself, not the kind that is playful, but the kind that is in earnest, for this kind fills even genuine friendship with distrust, often falling in together with it, if we are not on our guard. Now Gobryas, having rushed together with the Magus into a dark chamber as he fled, and finding himself grappling with him, when Darius stood over them hesitating, told him to thrust his sword through both of them alike. But as for us, if we in no way at all approve the saying, "Let friend perish along with foe," in seeking to tear the flatterer away from the friend, entangled with him as he is through many resemblances, we must be very much on our guard lest we either cast out the useful along with the bad, or, in sparing what is our own, fall victim to what does us harm. For just as, I think, wild seeds that are similar in shape and size to wheat and are mixed in with it are hard to winnow out, since they do not fall through the narrower openings of the sieve, or else fall through together with it through the wider ones, so too flattery, mingling itself with every feeling and every movement of friendship, and with its needs and its habitual intimacy, is hard to separate from it. That friendship is indeed the sweetest thing of all, and that nothing else gives more joy, is precisely why the flatterer too works by means of pleasures and is occupied with pleasures. And because gratitude and usefulness attend upon friendship, which is why a friend is said to be more necessary than fire and water, the flatterer, for this reason, throws himself into acts of service and competes to appear always eager, tireless, and zealous. And since what most holds together the beginning of a friendship is a likeness of pursuits and characters, and, in general, the fact of delighting in the same things and avoiding the same things is what first draws people together and unites them through a shared experience of feeling, the flatterer, having observed this, molds and shapes himself like some piece of material, seeking to fit and mold himself, through imitation, to whomever he attempts to catch. Being pliable and easily changed and persuasive in his assumed likenesses, so that one might say, not the son of Achilles, but that very man himself, you are he. And what is the most villainous thing of all about him is this. Perceiving that outspokenness, both the word and the reputation for it, is thought to be, as it were, the peculiar voice of friendship as a kind of living creature, and that the lack of outspokenness is unfriendly and ignoble, he has not left even this uncounterfeited. But just as skilled cooks use bitter flavors and harsh seasonings to take away the cloying quality of sweet foods, so flatterers offer not a true and beneficial outspokenness, but one that is, so to speak, mocking from beneath a raised eyebrow and merely tickling. The man is thus hard to catch out for these reasons, like those animals which, being naturally able to change color, blend themselves in with the colors and terrain beneath them. But since he deceives and conceals himself by means of resemblances, it is our task to uncover him through his differences and strip him bare, as Plato says, adorned with colors and shapes not his own, for want of his own. Let us, then, examine this from the very starting point. We said that the starting point of friendship for most people is a disposition and nature that readily embraces the same customs and characters, and takes pleasure in the same pursuits, affairs, and pastimes, sharing a common feeling. A disposition of which it has also been said, an old man has the sweetest speech for an old man, a child for a child, and a woman is congenial to a woman, and a sick man to one who is sick, and a man seized by misfortune is a charm to one undergoing trial. The flatterer then, knowing that delighting in what is alike, and using and loving it is something innate, tries first by this means to draw near to each person and pitch his tent beside him, as it were, in certain pasturing grounds, quietly grazing alongside him and taking on his color in the same pursuits and pastimes, the same concerns and ways of life, until he affords a handhold and, as one touches him, becomes tame and familiar, blaming the very things, lives, and people that he perceives the other man is annoyed by, and praising what pleases him, not moderately, but so as to go to excess with astonishment and wonder, and confirming the other's loves and hatreds as arising from judgment rather than mere feeling. How, then, is he exposed, and by what differences is he caught, since he is not actually alike nor becomes so, but only imitates likeness? First, one must observe the evenness of his purpose and its consistency, whether he always delights in the same things and always praises the same things and directs and establishes his own life toward one single model, as befits a free man who is a lover of a friendship and an intimacy of like character. For such is the friend. The flatterer, on the other hand, having no single, fixed hearth of character, and living no life of his own choosing, but molding and fitting himself to another and toward another, is not simple or single but manifold and versatile, flowing, like water being poured from vessel to vessel, always into some other place, and taking the shape of whatever receives him. For the monkey, it seems, in trying to imitate a man, is caught out by moving and dancing along with him. But the flatterer himself lures and entices others, imitating them not all in the same way, but dancing and singing along with one man, while wrestling and getting covered in dust along with another. And if he lays hold of one devoted to hunting with hounds, he all but cries out the words of Phaedra. By the gods, I long to halloo the hounds as I pursue the dappled deer. And it is no concern of his what the quarry is, but he nets and ensnares the hunter himself. And if he is hunting a young man fond of learning and literature, he is at once found among books, with a beard let grow down to his feet, wearing the philosopher's cloak as his hallmark and an air of indifference, and numbers and Plato's right-angled triangles are forever on his lips. And if some easy-going, wine-loving, wealthy man has fallen into his snares, then much devising Odysseus was stripped bare of his rags. The cloak is thrown off, the beard is shorn like a fruitless harvest, and wine coolers and drinking bowls and laughter in the promenades and jibes against those who philosophize appear instead. Just as they say happened at Syracuse, when Plato arrived and Dionysius was seized with a mad passion for philosophy. And the palace was full of dust from the crowd of men drawing geometrical figures. But when Plato gave offense, Dionysius, falling away from philosophy, came rushing back again into drinking bouts and trifling women and nonsense and dissipation, and all his court alike, as if transformed in the house of Circe, were overtaken by a forgetfulness of culture and by simple-mindedness. The deeds of great flatterers, too, and of demagogues bear witness to this, the greatest of whom was Alcibiades. At Athens jesting, keeping horses, and living with wit and grace. At Sparta having his hair cropped close, wearing the coarse cloak, and bathing in cold water in Thrace warring and drinking. And when he came to Tissaphernes, adopting luxury, softness, and ostentation. He won over and ingratiated himself with each people by assimilating and making himself at home with them all. Yet Epaminondas was not such a man, nor was Agesilaus. Rather, though they associated with very many men, cities, and ways of life, they everywhere preserved the character proper to themselves, in dress, in manner of living, in speech, and in life. So too Plato at Syracuse was the same man he was in the academy, and toward Dionysius the same as he was toward Dion. But one could most easily detect the flatterer's shifts, like those of a polyp, by oneself appearing to turn in many directions, and by finding fault with a way of life he had previously praised, while suddenly embracing, as though they pleased him, the very affairs, ways of living, or arguments that he had before been annoyed by. For one will see that he is nowhere steady or truly his own, nor does he love and hate and rejoice and grieve out of feelings that are his own, but like a mirror, he takes up images of feelings, ways of life, and movements that belong to someone else. Such a man is he that, if you find fault with one of your friends in his presence, he will say, "You have been slow to detect the man, for I myself never liked him either." But if, changing course, you praise the man instead, he will swear by Zeus that he shares your delight and is grateful on the man's behalf, and that he trusts him. And if you say that you must change to a different way of life, say, from public affairs to a life of retirement and quiet, "Changing," he says, "long ago we ought to have been rid of tumults and envies." But if you seem again to be starting up to act and speak, he chimes in, "You think thoughts worthy of yourself, but freedom from business is sweet, yet inglorious and low." One must say straight away to such a person, "You appear changed to me, stranger, from what you were before. I have no need of a friend who shifts along with me and nods along with me, for a shadow does this even better. I need one who shares in truth-telling and shares in judgment with me." This, then, is one manner of testing. But there is another difference to watch for among the resemblances. The true friend is neither an imitator of everything nor an eager praiser of everything, but only of the best things, for he is disposed, in the words of Sophocles, not to join in hating, but to join in loving, and, by Zeus, to join in setting right and to join in loving the good, not to join in erring or in wrongdoing together. Unless someone, like the discharge and staining of an eye infection, unwillingly fills him through association and habit with some fault or offense. It is said, for instance, that Plato's intimates imitated his stoop, Aristotle's imitated his lisp, and King Alexander's imitated the tilt of his neck and the roughness of voice in conversation. For many people unwittingly pick up a great deal both from characters and from ways of life. But the flatterer has exactly the experience of the chameleon. That creature assimilates itself to every color except white, and the flatterer, being unable to make himself like his patron in matters worthy of seriousness, leaves nothing shameful unimitated. Rather, like poor painters who cannot attain to what is beautiful and so, through weakness, transfer their likenesses into wrinkles and moles and scars, so he becomes an imitator of intemperance, of superstition, of irascibility, of bitterness toward servants, of distrust toward relatives and kin. For by nature, he is inclined of himself toward the worse, and seems to be very far from finding fault with what is shameful while he is imitating it. For those who emulate the better things and appear vexed and displeased at their friends' faults are objects of suspicion. This is exactly what slandered and destroyed Dion in the eyes of Dionysius, Samius in the eyes of Philip, and Cleomenes in the eyes of Ptolemy. But the man who wishes both to be and to seem equally pleasant and trustworthy pretends rather to rejoice even at the worst things, as though, out of excessive affection, he is not even displeased by what is base, but becomes sympathetic with and of one nature with everyone. Hence such men do not even think it right to be exempt from the misfortunes and chance mishaps of their friends, but pretend to be sick in like manner, flattering the sickly, and pretend neither to see sharply nor to hear well, if they keep company with the somewhat blind or somewhat deaf. Just as the flatterers of Dionysius, feigning dim sight, would stumble into one another and knock over the side dishes at dinner. Some, laying hold even more closely of their patron's sufferings, insinuate themselves still deeper and mix their show of shared feeling in as far as secrets. For on perceiving that men are unfortunate in marriage, or suspicious of their sons, or wary of their kin, they themselves spare nothing of their own and lament over their own children or wife or relatives or household, revealing certain secret grievances of their own. For likeness makes people more sympathetic toward one another, and having as it were received the other's confidences as hostages, they let slip some of their own secrets in return, and having let them slip, they trade on them and are afraid to abandon the trust placed in them. I myself know of a man who joined in casting out his own wife when his friend dismissed his, yet he was secretly visiting her and exchanging messages with her, and was caught out when the friend's wife noticed it herself. So inexperienced was that friend of what a flatterer is, thinking that these iambic lines belonged rather to the crab than to the flatterer. A belly is his whole body, an eye that looks everywhere, a beast that crawls upon its teeth. For such a portrait as this belongs rather to those who are friends of the frying pan and of the morning after breakfast, as Eupolis says. However that may be, let us set these matters aside for their proper place in the discourse. But let us not pass over this piece of sophistry in the flatterer's imitations, that even when he imitates something fine belonging to the man he is flattering, he still preserves the superiority for that man. For among true friends, there is no rivalry toward one another and no envy. Even if they are equal in success, or even lesser, they bear it without resentment and with moderation. But the flatterer, always mindful of taking second place, concedes the appearance of equality, admitting that he is inferior and left behind in everything except in base things. In base things, however, he does not concede first place, but says, if the other is ill-tempered, that he himself is melancholic, if the other is superstitious, that he himself is possessed by a god, that the other is in love, but he himself is mad. You laughed out of season, he says, but I was dying of laughter. In good things, though, it is the opposite. He himself says he runs fast, but the other flies. He himself rides fairly well, but what is that next to the centaur? I am a naturally gifted poet and write no mean verse, but the thundering is not mine, but Zeus's. For by imitating, he seems at the same time to be declaring the other's disposition to be fine, and by conceding defeat, to be declaring the other's power unattainable. Such, then, are some of the differences between the flatterer and the friend in the matter of imitation. But since, as has been said, the element of pleasure is also common to both, for the good man rejoices in his friends no less than the base man rejoices in his flatterers, come, let us mark out this distinction too. The distinction lies in the relation of the pleasure to its end. Consider it this way. Fragrance is present in perfume, and it is present also in a medicinal remedy. But they differ in that the one exists for pleasure and for nothing else, while in the other the purging or warming or fleshing effect of the remedy's power is what is fragrant, incidentally. Again, painters mix bright colors and dyes, and some medical drugs too have a bright appearance and a color that is not unpleasant. What, then, is the difference? Clearly we shall distinguish them by the end for which they are used. So too, in the same way, the favors of friends have their delightfulness blooming, as it were, upon some fine and beneficial purpose, though there are times when they make use also of play, and the table and wine, and, by Zeus, of laughter and banter with one another, as seasonings to what is fine and serious. It is to this that the line applies. They delighted in telling tales to one another, and nor would anything else have parted us, loving and delighting in each other. But for the flatterer, this trifling is his whole business and his whole end. Always to cook up and season some game or act or word for the sake of pleasure and toward pleasure. To put it briefly, the one man thinks he must do everything so as to be pleasant, while the other, always doing what is needful, is often pleasant and often unpleasant, not aiming at the latter, yet not avoiding it either, if it should prove better. For just as a physician, if it is advantageous, adds saffron or spikenard, and often, by Zeus, bathes his patient gently and nourishes him kindly, yet at other times sets these aside and administers castor oil or the heavy-smelling germander, which indeed smells most dreadful. So the friend, when leading someone toward the good with praise and grace, magnifying and delighting him, is like the man who says, Teucer, dear head, son of Telamon, lord of men, shoot thus. Or, at other times, he forces someone, grinding it up, to drink hellebore, making neither the unpleasantness in the one case nor the pleasure in the other his end, but through both leading the one under his care toward the single goal of what is advantageous. So too the friend, sometimes magnifying and delighting with praise and grace, leads toward the good, as in this line, Teucer, dear head, son of Telamon, lord of men, shoot thus. And how then could I forget godlike Odysseus? But again, where correction is needed, he takes hold with a biting word and a caring frankness. You are foolish, Menelaus, nurtured by Zeus, you have no need of this folly. And there are times when he joins the deed to the word as well, as Menedemus did when, by shutting his door on the dissolute and disorderly son of his friend Asclepiades, and refusing to speak to him, he brought the young man to his senses. And as Arcesilaus did when he barred Botto from his school, after Botto had written a verse against Cleanthes for a comedy. But when Cleanthes had persuaded him and he had repented, they were reconciled. For a friend must pain us while benefiting us, but must not destroy the friendship by paining us. Rather, he must use his frankness like a biting medicine, one that saves and preserves the patient it treats. Hence the friend, like a musician, by his shifting toward what is fine and advantageous, now relaxing, now tightening, is often pleasant but always beneficial. The flatterer, however, accustomed always to strum the same single note of pleasure and favor, knows neither a resisting deed nor a painful word, but attends only to what his patron wishes, always singing and speaking in tune with him. Just as Xenophon says that Agesilaus was glad to be praised by those who were also willing to blame him, so one must consider that which delights and gratifies to be a mark of friendship only if it can also sometimes pain and resist. But one must suspect the company that offers a continuous stream of pleasures and holds always to an unmixed and unbiting favor. And indeed, by Zeus, one should keep ready the saying of the Spartan who, when King Charilus was being praised, said, "How can this man be good, when he is not even harsh to the wicked?" Now, they say the gadfly settles in near the ear on bulls, and the tick on dogs. But among the ambitious, it is the flatterer who, taking hold of their ears with praise and clinging fast there, is hard to shake off. For this reason, one must keep one's judgment especially wide awake and watchful here, observing whether the praise is directed at the deed or at the man. Praise is of the deed if people praise us more when we are absent than when we are present. If, wishing the same things themselves and pursuing the same goals, they praise not us alone but everyone who acts similarly. If they do not appear now doing and saying one thing, now the opposite. And, greatest of all, if we ourselves recognize that we are not regretting the things for which we are praised, nor ashamed of them, nor wishing rather that the opposite of these things had been done and said by us. For the inner judgment that testifies against us and refuses to admit the praise is unaffected and untouched and unconquerable by the flatterer. Yet somehow most people do not endure consolation in their misfortunes, but are led rather by those who join in lamenting and mourning with them. Whereas when they have erred and gone wrong, the one who by rebuke and blame produces a sting of conscience and repentance seems to be an enemy and an accuser, while they welcome and consider well-disposed and a friend the one who praises and extols what has been done. Now, those who readily praise and applaud any act or word, whether done in earnest or in jest, are harmful only for the present moment and in what lies immediately at hand. But those whose praises reach as far as a man's character, and by Zeus, touch his disposition with flattery, do the same thing as those household servants who steal not from the grain heap but from the seed stock. For they pervert the disposition and character, which is the seed of one's actions and the source and spring of one's life, clothing vice in the names of virtue. For in times of civil strife and war, Thucydides says, men exchange the customary meaning of words for deeds, according to their own judgment. Reckless daring was accounted courage loyal to one's comrades, prudent hesitation, a specious cowardice, moderation, a cloak for unmanliness, and being intelligent about everything meant being idle about everything. So too in flatteries one must watch and be on guard. Prodigality being called generosity, and cowardice called caution, rashness called quickness of mind, and pettiness called self-control. While the lustful man is called devoted and affectionate, the irascible and arrogant man is called courageous, and the mean and abject man is called kind to his fellow men. So too, Plato says, the lover, being a flatterer of his beloved, calls the snub-nosed boy charming, the hook-nosed one kingly, dark-skinned boys manly, and pale ones children of the gods. And the sallow complexion is altogether the lover's own invention, born of his pet naming and easy tolerance of the boy's paleness. And yet a man persuaded that he is handsome when he is ugly, or tall when he is short, does not remain long in the deception, and suffers only a light harm, not an incurable one. But the praise that accustoms a person to treat vices as though they were virtues, not resenting them but delighting in them, and that strips away shame for one's own wrongdoing. This is what ruined the Sicilians, calling the cruelty of Dionysius and Phalaris a hatred of wickedness. This is what destroyed Egypt, naming Ptolemy's effeminacy, his fits of possession, his shrieking, and his gashing to the sound of drums piety, and service of the gods. This very nearly overturned and destroyed the character of the Romans at that time, calling Antony's luxuries and licentiousness and revelries cheerful and generous doings, when the power and fortune that dealt with him so ungrudgingly gave those doings pet names. And what else did it fasten upon Ptolemy but a halter and pipes? And what did it fix upon Nero but a tragic stage and masks and buskins? Was this not the praise of flatterers? Most kings, if they hum a tune, are hailed as Apollos, if they get drunk, as Dionysuses, if they wrestle, as Heracleses, and, delighting in being so addressed, they are led by flattery into every kind of disgrace. For this reason, one must guard most of all against the flatterer in the matter of praise. And this has not escaped the flatterer himself either. He is clever at guarding against suspicion. If he lays hold of some purple-bordered official or boorish man of thick hide, he uses the whole force of his nose, so to speak, just as Struthias did, strutting about at Bias's side and dancing over the man's insensibility with his praises. You have drunk more than Alexander the king, and I laugh when I think of the Cyprian. But when he sees more refined men paying especially close attention to him at just this point, and guarding this very territory and ground, he does not bring on his praise directly, but leads it far around in a circle, and only then approaches, as though touching and testing a wild creature noiselessly. For at one moment, he reports to the man the praises of certain others concerning him, just as orators do, making use of another's persona, saying that strangers or elders in the marketplace were most glad to be in his company, recalling many good things about him and admiring him. And then again, at another time, having fabricated and pieced together some light and false charges against him, he arrives as though he had heard them from others, with an air of earnestness, inquiring where the man said this or where he did that. And when the man denies it, as is likely, he seizes on this at once and flings him headlong into praises. But I was amazed that you would have spoken ill of any of your intimates, when you yourself, who were not even born to hate your enemies, have gone after your own friends, though you give away so much of your own. Others again, like painters who intensify their bright and luminous colors by setting them beside shadow and darkness, so by blaming the opposite qualities, by abuse or mockery or ridicule, disguise the faults that cling to the men they flatter, praising and fostering them under cover of censure. They condemn self-control, for instance, as boorishness in men who are dissolute, and among the grasping and the criminal and those who grow rich from shameful and wicked dealings, they condemn contentment and justice as timidity and want of enterprise. And when they keep company with idle triflers who shun public affairs and the middle course of civic life, they are not ashamed to call political engagement meddlesome drudgery, and honorable ambition, barren vanity. There are even times when a rhetorician's flattery disparages a philosopher, and among unchaste women those who call faithful, husband-loving wives, frigid, and provincial, win high esteem. But the flatterers exceed all bounds of villainy in not even sparing themselves. Just as wrestlers make their own bodies low so as to throw their opponents, so by belittling themselves they slip into making their neighbors objects of admiration. I am a coward slave at sea, one says. I give up before hardships, I fly into a rage when I am spoken ill of, but of him, he says, there is nothing to fear, nothing malicious. He is a man apart who bears everything calmly, everything without distress. And if there is someone who thinks himself a man of great sense and wishes to be thought stern and outspoken, and out of a kind of rectitude is always ready to quote, "Son of Tydeus, neither praise me overmuch nor find fault." The skilled flatterer does not approach him in that way at all, but has another device for such a case. He comes to him about some private business of his own, as though to consult a superior wisdom, and says that though he has other intimate friends, he is compelled to trouble this man. "For where," he says, "are we to turn who need advice? Whom are we to trust?" Then, having heard whatever the man says, he goes away declaring that he has received not counsel but an oracle. And if he sees the man laying claim also to some skill in literature, he hands him something he himself has written, asking him to read it over and correct it. Some of King Mithridates' companions, since he had a passion for medicine, offered themselves to be cut and cauterized by him, flattering him in deed rather than in word. For by being trusted by him, they were made to seem to bear witness to his skill. Many are the forms this spirit takes, and this class of flatterers, who decline outright praise, requires a shrewder caution to expose them, deliberately proposing absurd counsels and suggestions and making groundless corrections. For by contradicting nothing, but nodding assent to everything and accepting everything and crying out at every point, "Well done, excellent," he becomes plainly detectable as one asking for the password, hunting for some other prize, wishing to praise and to join in the general infatuation. And further, just as some have declared painting to be silent poetry, so there is a kind of flattery that praises in silence. For just as hunters, if they seem to be doing something other than hunting, traveling, or pasturing flocks, or farming, escape the notice of their quarry all the more, so flatterers most effectively lay hold of men with their praise when they do not seem to be praising, but doing something else. The man who yields his seat and his couch to one approaching, or who, speaking before the people or the council, notices that one of the rich wishes to speak, breaks off in the middle and yields him the platform and the floor. He shows, by his silence, more than by any shout, that he considers that man his superior and outstanding in judgment. Hence one can see such men securing the front seats at lectures and in theaters, not because they think themselves worthy of them, but so that they may flatter the rich by giving way to them, and taking the lead in speaking at meetings and councils, then yielding as to their betters, and shifting most readily to the opposite view, provided the man who disagrees is powerful or rich or held in honor. It is especially in the case of such crouching and retreating that one must expose the flatterer. Men who yield not to experience, nor to virtue, nor to age, but to wealth and reputation. For when Megabyzus sat down beside the painter Apelles and wished to talk about line and shadow, Apelles said, "Do you see these boys grinding the pigment? While you were silent, they paid close attention to you and admired your purple robe and your gold ornaments. But now they are laughing at you, since you have begun to talk about things you have not learned." And Solon, when Croesus asked him about happiness, declared a certain Tellus, a man of no distinction at Athens, and Cleobus and Biton, to have been more fortunate. But flatterers proclaim kings and rich men and rulers to be not merely blessed and fortunate, but foremost in wisdom and skill and every virtue. And whereas some cannot bear even to hear the Stoics call the wise man at once rich, handsome, well-born, and a king, flatterers declare the rich man to be at once orator and poet, and if he wishes, painter and flute player too, and swift of foot and strong of body, letting themselves be thrown in wrestling and falling behind him in running, just as Crison of Hymra let himself fall behind Alexander in a race, and Alexander, perceiving it, was angry. And Carneades used to say that the sons of the rich and of kings learn nothing well and properly except horsemanship. For in their studies their teacher flatters them by praising them, and their wrestling partner lets himself be thrown, whereas the horse, not knowing or caring who is a commoner or a ruler, rich or poor, throws off those who cannot ride it. So Bion's remark was simple and foolish. If a man, by praising a field, were going to make it productive and fruitful, then surely he would not be thought mistaken in doing this, rather than digging and laboring over it. So too a man would not be strange for loving praise, if praise were of benefit and profit to the one praised. But a field does not become worse for being praised, whereas men are puffed up and ruined by those who praise falsely and beyond their desert. Let this suffice then on this subject. Let us next examine the matter of frankness of speech. For it was fitting that, just as Patroclus, when he put on Achilles' armor and drove out his horses to battle, did not dare to touch the spear of Pelion alone, but left it behind, so the flatterer, though he equips and fashions himself with all the badges and tokens of a friend, should leave untouched and unimitated frankness alone, as the special and weighty and mighty burden proper to friendship. But since, in fleeing the kind of frank reproof that comes with laughter and unrestrained jesting and mockery and playfulness, they now raise the matter to a grave and solemn pitch, and flatter with a scowling face, mixing in some blame and admonition, come, let us not leave this untested either. I think that, just as in Menander's comedy the false Heracles comes forward, carrying a club that is not solid or strong but a hollow, empty sham, so the frankness of the flatterer will appear, to those who test it, soft and light and lacking any real tension, but doing just what women's pillows do. They seem to push back and resist the head, but instead give way and yield all the more. So this counterfeit frankness, being an empty, false, and treacherous swelling, is puffed up and swollen, so that when it collapses and gives way, it may receive and drag down along with itself the one who falls upon it. For true and friendly frankness fastens upon actual faults, bringing a pain that is salutary and solicitous, like honey biting into wounds and cleansing them, but otherwise beneficial and sweet, a subject on which there will be a discussion of its own. The flatterer, on the other hand, first displays himself as harsh and impetuous and inexorable toward others. For he is severe with his own servants, and quick to pounce on the failings of relatives and household members, admiring and respecting no one outside his circle, but looking down on them, and unforgiving and slanderous in provoking others to anger, hunting for a reputation as a hater of wickedness, as one who would never willingly relax his frankness with them, nor do nor say anything to please them. And then, while pretending to know and recognize none of their real and great faults, he is quick to pounce with vehemence and force upon their small and external shortcomings. If he sees a utensil carelessly left lying about, if a house kept badly, if someone neglecting a haircut, or a cloak, or a dog, or a horse, not caring for it properly. But neglect of parents, and carelessness toward children, and dishonoring a wife, and contempt for one's own household, and the ruin of one's fortune, are nothing to him. He is voiceless and timid about these, like a trainer who lets his athlete get drunk and indulge himself, and then is severe about an old flask or a scraper. Or like a grammar teacher who scolds a boy about his writing tablet and pen, but seems not to hear when he makes solecisms and barbarisms in speech. For such is the flatterer, just as it is with a bad and ridiculous public speaker. He says nothing about the speech itself, but finds fault with the voice, and complains bitterly that he is ruining his throat by drinking cold water, and when told, against his will, to go through a wretched composition, he blames the paper as being too rough, and calls the copyist filthy and careless. So too, when courting Ptolemy, who fancied himself a lover of learning, they would fight until midnight over a point of grammar or a line of verse or a piece of history, but when he indulged in cruelty and violence, and in torturing and executing men, not one of all that number stood in his way. It is as if someone, faced with a man covered in tumors and fistulas, were to use a surgeon's scalpel to trim his hair and his nails. Just so flatterers apply frankness only to the parts that give no pain and cause no distress. And still others, more cunning than these, employ frankness and fault-finding for the sake of pleasure. So Agis the Argive, when Alexander was giving great gifts to a certain buffoon, cried out from envy and vexation, "Oh, what utter absurdity!" And when the king turned on him in anger and said, "What is it you are saying?" he replied, "I confess I am vexed and indignant, seeing that all of you who are born of Zeus alike take delight in flatterers and ridiculous men. For Heracles too took pleasure in certain Cercopes, and Dionysus in Cyllene, and among your own court one can see men of that sort held in high favor. And when Tiberius Caesar once entered the Senate, one of his flatterers stood up and said that free men ought to speak frankly and hold nothing back, nor keep silent about what was to their advantage. And having thus aroused everyone's attention, when silence fell and Tiberius was listening intently, he said, 'Hear me, Caesar. There is a thing we all charge against you, and no one dares to say it openly. You neglect yourself and expose your body and wear yourself out continually with cares and toils on our behalf, resting neither by day nor by night. And as he went on stringing together many such things, they say the orator Cassius Severus remarked, "This frankness will be the death of this man." These, however, are lesser matters. Those that follow are already grievous and injurious to fools, whenever flatterers accuse men of the opposite passions and maladies. As Himerius the flatterer reviled one of the richest and stingiest and most miserly men in Athens as a spendthrift and careless, one who would go hungry along with his children. Or as, conversely, they reproach the extravagant and lavish for pettiness and meanness, as Titus Petronius did with Nero. Or as they urge rulers who treat their subjects harshly and cruelly to lay aside their excessive leniency and their untimely and unprofitable pity. Like these two is the man who pretends to be on his guard against, and to fear, someone who is really simple-minded and dull and foolish, as though he were formidable and cunning, and the flatterer of the envious man, who always delights in speaking ill of others and finding fault, if ever being drawn out, he praises one of the distinguished, taking hold of him and contradicting him as though he had a disease, this praising of men who are worthless. Who indeed is this man, or what brilliant thing has he said or done? But it is above all in matters of love that flatterers set upon those they flatter and fan the flames further. For seeing brothers at odds, or men scorning their parents, or looking down upon their own wives, they neither admonish nor reproach them, but even intensify their anger further, saying, "You do not realize your own worth, and you are the cause of this, always behaving obsequiously and with servility." But if against a courtesan or an adulterous mistress some itch of anger and jealousy should arise, flattery is at once on hand with brilliant frankness, bringing fire to fire, pleading the case and accusing the lover of doing many unlovely, harsh, and reprehensible things. O ungrateful man, of her frequent kisses. So did Antony's friends persuade him, burning with love for the Egyptian queen, that it was he who was loved by her, and, reviling him, called him unfeeling and arrogant. For the woman, having abandoned so great a kingdom and a life of happy pursuits, wastes away campaigning at your side, keeping the guise of a mere concubine, while you have an unmoved heart within your breast, and you look on unconcerned while she grieves. And he, delighted to be convicted of wrongdoing, and pleased with his accusers no less than with those who praised him, did not notice that he was being further corrupted by the one who seemed to be admonishing him. For this kind of frankness resembles the love bites of unchaste women, arousing and titillating, under the pretense of causing pain, the very pleasure it seems to hurt. And just as, when men mix unmixed wine, which is otherwise a remedy, with hemlock, they make the drug's power entirely beyond help, since it is carried up quickly to the heart by the wine's heat, so wicked men, knowing that frankness is a great help against flattery, use frankness itself as an instrument of flattery. This is why Bias did not answer well the man who asked him which creature was the most savage. He replied that among wild creatures it is the tyrant, and among tame ones the flatterer. It would have been truer to say that among flatterers some are tame, those found around the bathhouse and the dinner table, while the one who extends his meddling, slanderous, malicious reach, like tentacles, into the private chambers and the women's quarters, is savage and beast-like and hard to handle. There seems to be one particular way of guarding against him: to recognize and always remember that the soul has one part that is truthful, that loves what is noble and rational, and another part that is irrational, prone to falsehood, and given to passion. The friend is always present as counselor and advocate to the better part, like a physician fostering and preserving what is healthy, while the flatterer sits beside the passionate and irrational part and scratches and tickles it and wins it over and draws it away from reason, contriving for it certain base pleasures. Just as, among foods, there are some that attach themselves neither to the blood nor to the breath, nor lend any strength to sinew or marrow, but instead stir the genitals and rouse the belly and make the flesh flabby and unsound, so the flatterer's talk contributes nothing. To the part of the soul that thinks and reasons, but instead tames some pleasure of desire, or stretches an irrational spirit of anger, or stirs up envy, or breeds a heavy and empty swelling of pride, or joins in lamenting over grief, or makes the malicious, illiberal, and faithless part of the soul forever sharp, jumpy, and suspicious with certain slanders and premonitions. Such talk will not escape the notice of those who pay attention. For he always lurks beneath some passion and fattens it, appearing each time, like a swollen gland, at whatever part of the soul is ulcerous and inflamed. Are you angry? Punish him. Do you desire something? Buy it. Are you afraid? Let us flee. Do you suspect something? Believe it. But if the passions in these matters are hard to detect, because reason has been knocked out by their violence and magnitude, the flatterer will offer his hand more readily in small things, being the same man throughout. For instance, when someone under suspicion of some hangover or overindulgence hesitates about bathing or eating, the friend will hold him back, urging caution and attention. But the flatterer drags him off to the bathhouse and tells him to have some fresh dish served and not to torment his body by holding back. And seeing him growing faint-hearted about a journey, a voyage, or some undertaking, he will say the occasion is not urgent, and that the same thing can be accomplished by postponing it or by sending someone else. And if a man, having promised to lend or give money to a relative, regrets it but is ashamed to go back on his word, the flatterer, adding his weight to the worst side of the scale, strengthens his resolve to protect his purse and cuts away his sense of shame, urging him to be sparing on the ground that he spends a great deal already and ought to be enough help to many people as it is. Hence, if we do not conceal from ourselves our own desire, shamelessness, and cowardice, the flatterer will not escape our notice either. For he is always pleading the case of these very passions and speaking with apparent frankness about how they will turn out. So much, then, on this subject. Let us now turn to services and acts of assistance. For here, too, the flatterer creates great confusion, blurring his difference from the true friend by seeming tireless and eager in everything and never making excuses. For the friend's manner, like the story of truth according to Euripides, is simple, plain, and unaffected, whereas the flatterer's manner, being genuinely diseased in itself, needs many clever and, by Zeus, elaborate remedies. Just as in chance meetings, the friend sometimes says nothing and hears nothing but simply glances, smiles, gives and receives an inward look of goodwill and familiarity, and passes on, while the flatterer runs, chases after, greets from far off, and if he is spoken to first after being seen, excuses himself again and again with witnesses and oaths. So too, in practical affairs, friends leave many small things aside, not scrupulously working out every detail, not meddling, and not thrusting themselves into every service. The flatterer, by contrast, is here constant, persistent, and tireless, leaving no room or place for anyone else's service, wanting always to be given orders, and if he is not, feeling stung or rather utterly despondent and full of complaint. These, then, are signs, to men of sense, not of true or sound friendship, but of a friendship that plays the courtesan, entangling itself too readily around those in need. Still, one must first look for the difference in their promises. It was well said by those before us that the friend's promise is, if I am able to accomplish it, and if it is something that can be accomplished, while the flatterer's is, say whatever is on your mind. Indeed, the comic poets bring characters like this on stage. Set me, Nicomachus, against the soldier, if I don't beat him into a ripe melon all over, if I don't make his face softer than a sponge. Again, no true friend becomes a partner in an undertaking unless he has first become its advisor, and only after he has tested it and helped judge that it is fitting or advantageous. The flatterer, however, even if he is granted a role in testing and giving his opinion on the matter, is eager not only to yield and to please, but also fears seeming hesitant or reluctant to act, and so he gives way and joins in spurring the desire onward. For scarcely any rich man or king is ready to say, let me have a poor man, or, if he likes, one worse than poor, who, being well disposed toward me, will set fear aside and speak from the heart. But instead, like tragic actors, such men need a chorus of friends singing along with them or a theater applauding in unison. Hence, tragic Merope advises, as your friends, keep those who do not go slack in speech, and let the bolted door of your house shut out those base men who speak only to please and gratify you. But such men do just the opposite. Those who do not go slack in speech, but resist them for their own good, they shun. While those base men who speak to please, the illiberal, the tricksters, they admit not only within their bolted doors, but into their most secret feelings and affairs. Of these flatterers, the simpler sort does not think it his place, nor does he claim to be an advisor in matters of such weight, but merely an assistant and servant. The more cunning sort, however, stands sharing in the perplexity, knitting his brows and nodding along with his face, yet saying nothing, until the other man states his own opinion, whereupon he says, "Heracles, you just beat me to it. I was about to say the very same thing." For just as mathematicians say that surfaces and lines neither bend nor stretch nor move on their own, being purely intelligible and incorporeal, but bend, stretch, and shift together with the bodies whose boundaries they are, so too you will always catch the flatterer agreeing, declaring the same opinion, rejoicing, yes, by Zeus, and growing angry, right along with his patron. So that in these matters, at least the difference is entirely easy to detect. Still more, however, is it evident in the manner of their service. For the kindness that comes from a friend, like a living creature, keeps its most essential powers deep within, and nothing showy or ostentatious attends it. Often, just as a doctor cures a patient without his even knowing it, a friend does good by intervening or by settling some matter, caring for someone while he remains unaware of it. Such a man was Arcesilaus. Among other instances, learning that Apelles of Chios, who was ill, was also in poverty, he came back to him bringing 20 drachmas, and sitting down beside him said, "Here there is nothing but these elements of Empedocles, fire and water and earth and the gentle height of air, but you are not even lying comfortably." And while adjusting his pillow, he quietly slipped the coins underneath it. When the old woman who attended him found the money and, astonished, reported it to Apelles, he laughed and said, "This is one of Arcesilaus' thefts." And indeed, in philosophy, children born do resemble their parents. Lasides, for instance, a pupil of Arcesilaus, stood by Cephisocrates, together with his other friends, when Cephisocrates was on trial on an impeachment charge. When the accuser asked for his signet ring, Cephisocrates quietly set it down beside him. Lasides, noticing, stepped on it with his foot and hit it, for the proof of guilt lay in that ring. After the verdict, while Cephisocrates was thanking the jurors, one of them, who it seems had seen what happened, told him to be grateful to Lasides and related the whole affair, since Lasides himself had told no one. In just this way, I think, the gods too do most of their good deeds unseen, taking pleasure by their very nature in the act of giving and doing good. The flatterer's work, however, has nothing just, true, simple, or generous about it. Instead, there is sweat, shouting, running to and fro, and a straining of the face that produces an impression and appearance of laborious, urgent service. Like an overworked painting that, with garish colors, broken folds of drapery, wrinkles, and sharp angles, manufactures an illusion of vividness. He is also tiresome in recounting how he acted on your behalf, rehearsing his wanderings and worries, then his quarrels with others, then countless troubles and great sufferings, until one is tempted to say the reward was not worth all that. For every kindness thrown back in one's face is oppressive, thankless, and unbearable, but with the favors of flatterers, the reproachful, embarrassing quality is present not later, but from the very moment they are being performed. The true friend, if it becomes necessary to mention the matter at all, reports it modestly and says nothing about himself. Thus, when the Spartans sent grain to the Smyrnaeans in their need, and the Smyrnaeans marveled at the kindness, they said, "It is nothing much, we simply voted to go without our own breakfast, and that of our pack animals, for a single day, and gathered this from what we saved." Such a kindness is not only generous, but also more pleasant to those who receive it, because they believe that those who benefit them are not being greatly harmed by it. One would not, then, recognize the flatterer's true nature chiefly from the tiresomeness of his services or the readiness of his promises, but rather from whether the service itself is honorable or shameful, and whether it aims at pleasure or at benefit. For the true friend does not, as Gorgias maintained, expect his friend to render him just services while he himself performs many unjust ones in return. His nature is to share in soundness of mind, not to share in sickness. He will rather turn his friend away from what is not fitting, and if he cannot persuade him, there is that fine saying of Phocion to Antipater, "You cannot have me as both friend and flatterer, that is, as both a friend and no friend at all." For one must work together with a friend, not join in his knavery, take counsel with him, not join in his scheming, bear witness with him, not join in deceiving, and share his misfortune by Zeus, not share in his wrongdoing. Indeed, merely sharing knowledge of a friend's shameful acts is not even desirable. How much less desirable, then, is joining in doing them and sharing the disgrace? Just as the Spartans, defeated in battle by Antipater and negotiating terms, asked him to impose on them whatever penalty he wished, so long as it was not shameful, so too the true friend, when some need arises involving expense, danger, or toil, insists on being called first and taking part without excuse and eagerly. But where shame is involved, he asks only to be left alone and spared. Flattery does just the opposite. In laborious and dangerous services it begs off, and if you test it by tapping, it rings back hollow and base under some pretext. But in shameful, lowly, and disreputable services, use me up, trample on me, it considers nothing terrible or degrading. You see the monkey. It cannot guard the house like the dog, nor carry burdens like the horse, nor plow the earth like the oxen. So it submits to abuse and buffoonery and puts up with being toyed with, offering itself as an instrument of laughter. So too the flatterer, unable to plead a case, contribute funds, or join in a struggle, and falling short in every kind of labor and earnest effort, is unstinting in clandestine, under-the-table affairs. A faithful servant of love affairs, meticulous in settling a prostitute's fee, careful in working out the cost of a drinking party, never lazy in preparing dinners, attentive in tending mistresses, and when ordered to be insolent toward in-laws or to help drive out a wife, he is unyielding and unashamed. So the man is not hard to detect on this front either. Ordered to do whatever disreputable, dishonorable thing you like, he is ready to spare nothing of himself, so long as it pleases the one giving the order. And not least of all, one might see how very different he is from the true friend in his attitude toward that friend's other friends. For the true friend finds it most pleasant to love and be loved along with many others, and constantly works to make his friend widely loved and widely honored. Holding that friend's possessions are held in common, he thinks nothing ought to be so common as friends themselves. The flatterer, being false, spurious, and alloyed with base metal, and knowing above all that he is wronging friendship, counterfeiting it, as it were, like debased coinage, is envious by nature, but directs his envy against his equals, competing to outdo them in buffoonery and idle gossip, while he trembles and fears his superior, not by Zeus, like a foot soldier racing beside a Lydian chariot, but rather, as Simonides says, like lead set, beside refined gold unmixed. So then, being light, fusible, and deceptive, when he is set up close beside a true, weighty, hammered solid friendship for comparison, he cannot bear the test but is exposed, and does just what that painter did who painted roosters so badly. He used to order his slave boy to chase the real roosters as far as possible from his picture, and this flatterer likewise chases away true friends and does not let them come near. But if he cannot manage that, he openly fawns on the true friends, dances attendance on them, and pretends to be in awe of them as his betters, while secretly he lets slip and sows the seeds of slander against them. And when his hidden word has scratched open a wound, even if it does not do its full work at once, he keeps in mind and holds to the maxim of Medius. Medius was, as it were, the choir leader of the flatterers around Alexander, a master sophist arrayed in chief against the best men. He used to urge his fellows to attack boldly and bite with their slanders, teaching that even if the man bitten heals the wound, the scar of the slander will remain. And indeed, eaten away by such scars, or rather by gangrenes and cancers, Alexander destroyed Callisthenes, Parmenio, and Philotas, while to men like Hagnon, Bagoas, Aegisias, and Demetrius, he gave himself unstintingly to be tripped up, letting himself be bowed down to, dressed up, and remolded by them like some barbarian idol. So great a power has the desire to please, and it seems, it would appear, to be greatest of all in those thought to be the greatest of men. For believing oneself to possess the finest qualities, joined with the wish that it be so, gives the flatterer both credibility and courage. For while, among physical places, the heights are hard of approach and hard for plotters to reach, the height and pride that arise in a soul lacking sense, whether from good fortune or from natural gifts, is most readily accessible of all to the small and the lowly. Hence, at the beginning of this discourse, we urged, and now we urge again, that we cut out from ourselves self-love and self-conceit. For this, flattering us in advance, makes us softer prey for the flatterers who wait at our door, as though we were already prepared for them. But if, obeying the God, we learn how valuable, know thyself, is to each of us above all else, and so review our own nature, upbringing, and education, finding them to have countless deficiencies in goodness and much that is base and haphazardly mixed in among our actions, our words, and our passions, we will not so easily offer ourselves as a place for flatterers to walk about in. Alexander, for one, said he most distrusted those who proclaimed him a god whenever it came to sleeping and to sex, since in these matters he found himself becoming more ignoble and more subject to passion than his ordinary self. We too, seeing many shameful, distressing, incomplete, and mistaken things in ourselves in many places, will constantly discover that we stand in need not of a friend who praises and showers us with fine words, but of one who examines us, speaks frankly, and by Zeus, blames us when we act wrongly. For among the many, few are those who dare to speak frankly rather than to please their friends, and even among that few you will not easily find those who know how to do it, but rather those who suppose that if they scold and find fault, they are using frankness. And yet, like any other drug, frank speech that misses its proper occasion has the effect of causing needless pain and disturbance, and produces, in a way, distress of the sort that flattery produces pleasure. For people are harmed not only by being praised out of season, but also by being blamed. And this above all delivers them, easily caught and off balance, into the hands of flatterers, who, deflected from what is too harsh and resistant, slip toward what is soft and yielding, like water toward hollow ground. For this reason, frank speech must be tempered with good character, and must have reasoning that removes its excess and its unmixed intensity, as one tempers light, so that people, not being disturbed or pained by those who find fault with everything and blame everyone, may not take refuge in the shadow of the flatterer and turn away toward whatever gives no pain.